And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Environmentalism, it is a movement, it is a mission, it is to many the means to save our planet. Born in the conservation movement of the 1950s, it has changed the way we live and the way we understand planet Earth. But recently, the environmental community was shaken by a position paper that cut deep into long-held beliefs about the environmental movement. When we return, we bring you a special edition of the Wild Side News as we breathe life into the debate. Is environmentalism dead?
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
This is a special edition of the Wild Side News. Over the next 2 hours, you will hear from 9 leaders in the environmental movement who will respond to a recent paper that has stirred up serious debate about the future of the environmental movement. The death of environmentalism, global warming politics in a post-environmental world. Now, my regular listeners are aware that I have regularly championed the Apollo Alliance, a significant visionary alliance of environmentalists, unions, and politicos to craft a positive and powerful challenge to apply the nation's greatest will to once and for all move aggressively forward to achieve energy independence within 10 years, and in the process, create millions of jobs, invigorate our economy, restore the health of our environment, and America's place as a leader in innovation, ingenuity, and technology. Michael Schellenberger was instrumental in bringing the Apollo Alliance into play and made a bold attempt to get the Apollo Alliance interwoven into the 2004 election. But alas, the environment was hardly mentioned by either candidate, much to the chagrin of many in the environmental movement. Schellenberger, along with Ted Nordhaus, wrote and distributed The Death of Environmentalism at the October 2004 meeting of the Environmental Grantmakers Association, setting off a sour serenade of soliloquies from many of the directors, presidents, and officers of the major environmental organizations. The debate went public when Grist Online did an in-depth airing of the battle. You will find links to the Grist Online feature on today's show page. In the 2 hours ahead, the Wild Side News will bring you the voices of the earth as we hear from 9 leaders who are weighing in on this very controversial issue. We are sorry that we were not able to include Michael Schellenberger in this debate, but every attempt was made to bring his concerns to voice on today's show. I will therefore provide a brief summary of the 25-page The Death of Environmentalism treatise before we hear from our guests. The mission of today's show is to provide a cross-section of voices from the environmental community so that you can get a sense of the passions and feelings that the issue has generated. In order to provide a fair and balanced voice of the earth on this issue, I chose the order of guests randomly. Following my synopsis, you will hear from Michael Bruhn, Executive Director of RAN, the Rainforest Action Network. Then Paul Watson, president of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Organization. Then Dennis Hayes, president of the Bullitt Foundation, who will speak to us from Seattle. Doug Scott, senior policy director of the Campaign for America's Wilderness, will be followed by David Johns, board member of the Wildlands Project. Then Chip Ward, author of Hope's Horizon, will join us from Salt Lake. And Kathleen Rogers, executive director of the Earth Day Network, shares her thoughts. Then it's out to Washington, D.C. and the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, where Jeff DeBelko will give us his perspective. And we close out this special show from Durango, Colorado, where Vicky Cimarano, director of WildPack, will give her perspective. I encourage you to follow the links to the written items and realize that thanks to the wonders of the voice of the earth, you can visit and revisit this show anytime. So, let us now begin. We start with a brief synopsis of the death of environmentalism. I apologize to the authors for this attempt to summarize their lengthy analysis, but here goes. Michael Schellenberger and Ted Nordhaus wrote a piece entitled The Death of Environmentalism, which suggested that environmentalism was an outdated term, approach, and concept that had failed in addressing the most pressing environmental challenge facing America and the world, namely global warming. The piece, written in October of 2004, spurred quite a debate amongst leaders in the environmental community, with responses by Carl Pope of the Sierra Club, Phil Clapp of the National Environmental Trust, Francis Beinecke of the NRDC, Dan Carroll, board member of the Apollo Project, and Adam Werbach, past president of the Sierra Club. The debate was featured in Grist Online. Michael Schellenberger and Ted Nordhaus authored The Death of Environmentalism. Michael Schellenberger and Ted Nordhaus conclude that this failure of the environmental movement was due in large part to its major practitioners relying on the successes and therefore the strategies of the 60s and 70s, which was predicated on identifying a problem, developing the science to prove first its existence and then the fix, and then to put their focus on deriving incremental changes in legislation that would lead to the eventual goal. They suggest that to a large extent, part of the problem is that the environmental community sees the environment as a thing, something that they have the charge to protect, and that this thing is somehow separate from the broader complex of interdependence. By seeing the environment as their thing to protect, the environmental community has, to some degree, alienated themselves from the American culture and taken on the full responsibility for protecting it. They suggest that in order to address the larger problem of global warming, a full matrix of changes need to occur, primarily in framing the issue into the context of American culture and future, suggesting that the Apollo Project, which they are central parties to, which presented the challenge in terms of creating jobs to revitalize the U.S. economy and restore the environment in the effort to, in essence, retool the American system into a sustainable energy system, would more effectively unite the matrix of vision, will, politics, people, and the economy required to initiate rapid change. To this end, they suggest that environmental grant makers change their modus operandi from supporting environmental organizations to promoting a more all-encompassing strategy that more effectively leads to the dramatic changes that are necessary to accommodate to the social, economic, and natural readjustments that will necessarily develop as global warming manifests on the planet. That is the end of the synopsis. For the full text, follow the link provided on today's show page. It's a 25-page piece, but well worth an investigation. It will give you the background needed to really understand in depth what is about to follow. And now, the Wild Side News thanks all of the guests you are about to hear. May this serve to serve us all who work and have worked in the name of the American Environmental Movement. I'm talking with Michael Bruhn. He is the executive director of RAN, the Rainforest Action Network. Michael, you've been following this debate. I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Well, I'm actually quite appreciative of what Michael Schellenberger and Ted Nordhaus have done. They have sparked a much-needed, long-overdue conversation about the efficacy of the environmental movement. It's clear that we haven't had nearly the impact that we need to, and I think some changes are in order.
First of all, what is bringing about the need for this change?
As Michael and Ted point out, and as many have pointed out, if you look at nearly every single indicator of the health of the biosphere, the planet, we're losing many more battles than we're winning. Forests cover is the cover of ancient forests is being depleted every year. Biodiversity is plummeting. Our dependence on fossil fuels is only strengthening. And across almost every single issue, we have clearly much work to do. And I think the strategies, many of the strategies and tactics that are being used by environmentalists haven't been updated, they haven't been refined. And it's time for us to throw out the bad and start with something fresh.
Let's talk about what you think isn't working specifically, and then also let's talk about what you feel is needed to further the effort.
I think one of the things that isn't working is attempting to push progressive environmental legislation through Congress. We simply do not have courageous and visionary leaders, enough courageous and visionary leaders in the current Congress to pass any type of responsible environmental legislation whatsoever. What's needed is a greater and tougher grassroots movement that will simultaneously hold our elected officials accountable, Democrat and Republican, while also looking for different avenues to affect change, such as challenging corporations directly.
Now, are you finding models that you think embrace those techniques?
Well, I think that there's a lot of good news in regarding environmental activism. Some of the most exciting work that's being done recently is in the realm of challenging companies who are committing crimes against nature. Rainforest Action Network has been one organization among many that have helped to convince hundreds of companies to stop using wood coming from old-growth forests and to begin to have a policy of actually helping our planet rather than harming it. We've been able to convince Home Depot and Lowe's and Kinko's, Hallmark cards, literally hundreds of companies to stop selling or buying or using any wood or paper coming from old growth forests. And this type of corporate campaigning is actually leading to the protection of millions of acres of old growth forests in Canada, Indonesia, Chile, and elsewhere. There are a number of organizations that are working with this type of strategy in mind, Forest Ethics, American Lands Alliance, Natural Resources Defense Council. It's called markets campaigning, and it's one of the few techniques that environmentalists are employing right now that's having a big impact.
Some people who are involved in the environmental movement, of course, feel somewhat offended. They feel like they've been tossed out or that their work is being disempowered by the language. You know, is environmentalism dead? How can you help them understand why this change is critical at this time?
Well, I can understand why some people would feel as though their work hasn't been recognized. Yeah. What Michael and Ted did very well is to point out some of the flaws in the work that everyone in the environmental movement is engaged in, and pointing out some obvious facts that we're not having the impact that we should. What may have happened, and I can understand that this would have happened, is that some people who are doing heroic work and actually very successful work might have been painted with a broad brush. As a person working in the environmental field, I can certainly feel that way. There are some success stories out there, and there are some really inspiring case studies of how committed activists and volunteers are having a big impact on the world. I would say that if you're a grassroots environmental activist and if you're committed to justice, any type of social and environmental justice, you should take heart in the fact that people do care and that you're not alone. That there are literally tens of millions of Americans who believe that we must act to preserve the environment, and many Americans aren't even in the usual camps. They could be called conservatives, they could be Democrat or Republican. I see this as an opportunity to open our arms wider and to build a larger coalition to create the world that we all want to live in.
Let's say, for the sake of discussion, that environmentalism were to be considered and pronounced dead, what would you see replacing that? What is the new vision?
Well, I think you should ask Michael and Ted that. I'm sure you will. You know, I would say that I wouldn't pronounce it dead, personally. And I think that a new vision, some of the most successful work for social and environmental justice in the 21st century will be those campaigns that have a few different qualities. One quality is that the issues are made relevant to all Americans. So take, for example, our oil dependency. Oil dependency could easily be painted as an environmental problem, but it's not. It's a social problem. It's a global problem. Our dependence on oil doesn't just impact the environment. It impacts our health. It impacts our foreign policy. It determines whether we go to war or not. It impacts our trade deficit. And, of course, it impacts our economy and the job base that we have in the U.S. So the successful work that environmentalists engage in the 21st century will be those efforts that seek to broaden our list of allies and really welcome a family of Americans who simply want to make their country stronger and don't approach issues on a single or don't approach topics on a single issue basis. The other part of the vision is that I think we need to be tougher. I think we need to name specific names and specific companies or executives or government leaders who aren't telling the truth and who need to be given some feedback about the impacts that their decisions are having on the environment and the people who inhabit the planet.
You are someone who is involved, and your organization is involved, really in the global perspective to a large extent. And, of course, much of this debate is really being framed from the perspective of global warming and climate change.
Right.
I'd like your perspective on what you're seeing as well now around the world in terms of climate change.
Well, the paper, The Death of Environmentalism, was really a critique on how the American environmental movement is failing in its obligations to help correct American energy policy because of its impact on the world. Rainforest Action Network is an organization that has a relevant objective in that we are primarily a U.S.-based environmental organization that seeks to change American or North American consumption habits and corporate practices because of the impact that our practices and habits have on the rest of the world. Just as we need to change the way in which we consume our wood and paper because of the impact that it has on forests, or our consumption of beef because of the impact that it has on rainforests. Rainforest Action Network has now rededicated itself to focus on climate change and our use of energy because of the impact on indigenous people and species and all forests all around the world. Last year, I was with an indigenous community in Ecuador that was resisting an oil exploration project in the jungles of Ecuador, in a community called Sarayaku. And one of the leaders there told me, she said, as long as your country is drinking oil like it is water, we will never be free. We will never truly be free. And I think that story is being repeated dozens of times all around the world, in Nigeria, in Venezuela, in Peru, in Bolivia, in Indonesia, where our consumption of oil, our addiction to oil, is disturbing indigenous communities, leveling rainforests, and poisoning the planet and contributing to climate change. The U.S., of course, has just 5% of the world's population. It has 25% of the world's oil, or consumes 25% of the world's oil. And it's a moral responsibility for all Americans to work to break our oil addiction and to combat climate change before it's too late. Well, I think, the last thing that I want to say about The Death of Environmentalism is that, I think it's an unfortunate title. But I am quite grateful of the work that Michael and Ted have done. They're raising very important issues. And we need to win. We need to have a much more powerful effect on the largest American corporations than we're having right now and on our government officials. We're simply not inspiring our leaders to actually lead. And until we're actually changing environmental policy, we're not doing our job. And so I'm quite grateful for Michael and Ted for the fact that they simply held up a mirror to the environmental movement and said, take a look.
Michael Bruin, I want to thank you for adding your voice to the Wild Side News. We're talking with Paul Watson, who is the director of Sea Shepherd. Paul, first of all, let's give a little history on Sea Shepherd and you.
Well, I set the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society up in 1977 after leaving Greenpeace. I was one of the co-founders of the Greenpeace Foundation. And I set Sea Shepherd up as an organization to concentrate on upholding international conservation law on marine wildlife and habitats. So that's what we've been doing for almost 30 years now.
And, of course, there's a tremendous history which people can learn by going to seashepherd.org and learning about the ongoing work you're preparing to launch again to protect seals and whales. I applaud you for that.
Yeah, we're also involved with everything from invertebrates up to the great whales. You know, we're working in partnership with the Galapagos National Park. We provide a vessel there to assist in anti-poaching efforts, and we have an agreement with the government of Colombia to protect Mapello Island National Park. And we're now finding we're getting invited by other countries. For instance, I met in January with the president of Senegal, who wants Sea Shepherd to work with them to stop poaching in their waters.
Today I'd like to have you give your thoughts on a debate that's raging in the environmental community that was posed by Michael Schellenberger and Ted Nordhaus of, at least the Apollo Alliance. The question being, is environmentalism dead? What are your thoughts?
Well, I found it a bit arrogant for Schellenberger and Nordhaus to, based on interviews with 25 people from large so-called environmental organizations, to come to the conclusion that environmentalism is dead. In fact, it's far from dead. I mean, as someone who has been involved with the environmental movement right from its modern beginnings in the 1960s until now, I've seen it as a steady, ongoing, and more influential movement, certainly stronger now than it really ever has been. So I certainly disagree with what they're saying.
What do you think was the nature of their statement, is environmentalism dead? Is it a problem with definition?
Well, I think what they're trying to do is to have people get more involved with social justice issues and the politics of the Democratic Party, really. And they're saying that we should focus on labor issues, left-winged issues, that sort of thing, and not even use the word environment. I just really don't understand that at all. I mean, there is a social justice movement, and it's fine, but there is also an environmental movement. And there's been this attempt, and it's certainly been echoed in the pages of the Earth First Journal and Sierra Club and Earth Island, everywhere. There's this attempt to take over the environmental movement by the social justice movement. And, it used to be with Earth First, it was Earth First, but now it's sort of like, gay rights, human rights, women's rights first and Earth second, that sort of thing. You know, I'm more of an international conservationist. I work on the international level, so I'm involved with numerous countries and working worldwide. And so, therefore, I find this whole Nordhaus-Schellenberger thing really an American approach to it. It's really not taking into account the movement globally.
Let's talk about the global movement then, because that's a very interesting perspective, and it broadens the debate enormously. What do you see happening in terms of the environmental movement to save nature and the Earth?
Well, I think there is a global movement, and it's a decentralized movement, but based on more and more people becoming aware of what the problems are. And I'm especially excited to see developments in third world nations where, individuals and organizations are coming together and protecting everything from rainforests to local ecosystems, trying to protect water sources, make sure there's clean air. I mean, this is a new kind of thinking in many third world nations. And, now we're even seeing the Nobel Prize being given to people in Africa for their environmental work, which is something that was really unthinkable in the 70s. Nobody was really involved in that kind of thing. So this is why I say that this movement is growing, and more and more people are becoming involved, because I see the strength of this in its diversity. You know, I'm really don't have much faith in large environmental organizations. I think that what we need are hundreds of thousands of small organizations and individuals working on hundreds of thousands of different issues and all going towards the same objective.
Their main focus is inspired by what they claim to be a failure, but the U.S. environmental movement to address climate change and global warming. What about climate change and global warming on a global scale and its relationship to the environmental movement? That's kind of where they were suggesting the failure was occurring.
Well, the United States is pretty backward when it comes to environmental issues, and has become increasingly so since the 92 conference and the UN conference in Brazil on the environment. You know, they refused to sign the Biodiversity Treaty that year, and now they're refusing to sign the Kyoto Protocol. So the U.S. is choosing to, stay apart from the global concerns about the environment, and a lot of that has to do with the reactionary course of politics in this country. And when you have half of your population believing in pie-in-the-sky fantasies, and the world is and a good part of those that believe the world is only 4,000 years old, you got some serious problems. So we've actually got the incredible situation where the most powerful country in the world, certainly one of the most richest, is actually going back to the medieval times in their outlook on nature and reality.
Well, perhaps to help Schellenberger and Nordhaus and those who weigh in on that side, if it was your task to try to change this American perspective, what might you suggest?
Well, I don't know if it can be changed right now. The pendulum has to go all the way over. I think that Bush's extremism is going to result in some sort of reaction. For every action, there's a reaction. I think that's going to happen. I mean, he's going to push it so far, and then it's going to start pushing back.
You're on the ocean. What are you seeing in terms of the effect of climate change, global warming, from your perspective?
Well, what I'm seeing, the most serious problem in the world today is the diminishment of species. We're losing more species of plants and animals in such a short period of time. This has not really happened in the last 65 million years. But what we're also seeing is the impact of global warming on that. And, this change in ocean currents, the melting of the polar ice caps, both south and north, these things are happening. I find it's absolutely incredible that people deny that there's global warming when the evidence is there. You know, and for the last 30 years, I've seen a steady diminishment of marine species. 90% of the large fish in the ocean have been exterminated. That's according to the Pew Foundation report and other reports, most recently one by British scientists. You know, the oceans are dying in our time, as Jacques Cousteau pointed out just before he died. But, for the most part, the oceans are out of sight and out of mind. Nobody wants to really focus on them. You know, but there's really too many people and not enough fish is really what it comes down to.
Do you see systems that may be useful in turning that around?
Well, I have a lot of faith in, the laws of ecology. That's really what I live my life by, the three basic laws of ecology, the law of diversity, that strength lies in diversity, the law of interdependence, the species within ecosystems are interdependent upon each other, and the law of finite resources, that there's a limit to growth. And throughout natural history, any time a species has lived contrary to those laws of ecology, they've gone extinct, and the same will happen to us. I mean, we might take a lot of species with us, but we cannot live on this planet and not live in accordance with those basic ecological laws. I think the most important one being the law of finite resources. There's limits to growth. We've got to stabilize human populations because we're literally stealing the carrying capacity of other species in order to advance our own numbers.
As the world develops, and of course we have to embrace China as part of that, how are we going to deal with this? If we continue with a consumerist society, which of course is kind of a natural human desire to have good, neat stuff, what are we facing in the future? How would you suggest we might look at that?
Well, Jared Diamond just published a book called Collapse, and I think that it makes good reading for anybody to look at how civilizations have collapsed throughout history. And certainly the symptoms are there that this could happen to us. I mean, it's all smoke and mirrors right now. The United States is looked upon as the richest country in the world, but, it's trillions of dollars in debt. It's not really. It's all just on paper. This is going to crash. I mean, if everything was based on gold, it would have crashed a long time ago. It's just all an illusion. there's simply not enough resources in the world to allow for, say, third world nations to develop and compete with and become equal with the Western worlds as they are right now. In fact, it's going to go the other way. Europe and the United States, the industrialized countries, are going to crash. They're going to become impoverished. So not only will third world countries not be able to become more materially wealthy, the materially wealthy countries are going to become poorer. Well, what we're seeing, you know, in the 21st century are the wars over resources, where the wars in the 20th century were primarily over territory. We're now involved in oil wars. But, you know, within the next decade or so, we're going to see the water wars. And that's where it's going to get real vicious, you know, with conflicts over the rights to control water resources. You know, I certainly envision a war between Canada and the United States, because Canada is water rich and the U.S. is going to want it. So if they don't get it, they're going to take it. And it's as simple as that. And so there's going to be more and more conflicts over resources because of this law of finite resources. And so things, as for the environmental movement being dead, the environmental movement is stronger than has been and will become the most important movement in the history of the world. And so the environmental movement will grow considerably in the 21st century. So far from being dead, it's probably it's the only movement which has any hope for saving human society.
It is the future. We can't. Eventually, it will no longer be off the radar screen. I was appalled that, for example, in this last presidential election, there was one question in all of the debates that related to the environment. I found that unbelievable. It totally out of sync with any sense of the reality on this planet. Things like that scare me.
Well, yeah, and also in the last election, you know, one of the reasons the Democrats lost is the Democrats won't stand up for anything. I mean, they're just mini Republicans, Republicrats, I call them. And so there's really not a lot to offer there. And so people are choosing now to live in a world of illusions. Not only do they believe that, you know, God's running the country, but, I mean, if you listen to the president's inaugural address, I mean, at one point he said, you know, from the founding of this nation, we have looked upon all people as being equal. Well, what happened for the first 100 years, as I recall, a good part of the population were in slavery. How could he possibly say that? You know, but they've convinced themselves that, you know, this fantasy democracy that they are creeping around the world has been the most perfect democracy ever developed, and it's always been that way. So we've turned democracy into a religion, and one where faith is more important than fact.
Do you see some sort of global effort at trying to unite this sort of the politics of the planet in an effective way? I think there's a total lack of leadership on the planet. That's one of, and as you say, it's not only in the Democratic or the Republican Party, but it literally is around the globe.
The only leadership and the only dissent that's coming is really from the European nations, and I think that the European nations are actually poised to, you know, replace the United States as the most powerful you know, entity, a political entity on the planet, because not only they're progressing with what they have, of course they are doomed to collapse too, but they're doing so with a bit of a logic and rationale behind what they're doing. Where in the United States, the logic's gone out the window.
I know from my perspective, I live in California. We brag about the fact that we're the solar state and that we have 15,000 homes that are partially solar powered. And we think we've really accomplished something. But when you look to Japan, for example, that has 1 million homes, it puts this into perspective. And this is just a facade.
Well, it is. I mean, 15,000 out of a population of over 30 million. I mean, it's incredible. You know, you have to applaud those people who are doing this, but they're such a minority.
Paul Watson, I want to thank you for giving your thoughts and voice to the Voice of the Earth on the Wild Side News. Where are you off to now?
I'm on the national board of the Sierra Club, so I'm off to a Sierra Club meeting in Puerto Rico, of all places, and then back to the ship, and then up to protect seals off the east coast of Canada and to protect cod off of the Grand Banks of Newfoundland. So I'll be involved for the next 3 months.
Thank you so much. Let's continue this conversation again.
Thanks.
Now I'd like to talk with Dennis Hayes, who is the president of the Bullet Foundation in Seattle. First of all, Dennis, give us a little talk about what the Bullet Foundation does.
Well, the Bullet Foundation is a philanthropy based in Seattle, focused exclusively on the Pacific Northwest, trying to convert this corner of America and frankly the western part of Canada, British Columbia as well, into a sustainable society. So anything that will move any part of our industrial sector, or the economy in general, culture, cities, transportation systems, energy systems, towards sustainability, we're enthusiastic about and try to support.
Today's a very historic day. It is February 16th that we're talking, which is the launch of the Kyoto Protocols around the world. And that actually relates to the topic at hand, which is what Michael Schellenberger and Ted Nordhaus phrased as the death of environmentalism, particularly as it relates to that issue. What are your thoughts?
These are a couple of very smart people who titled their essay in an effort to be intentionally provocative and succeeded. They stirred up some serious questioning. It's, of course, a very long piece with a lot of assertions in it, but with reference to today, I think there's a core message that I agree with, which has been that not just the environmental community, but the scientific community and the world at large has been fixated on the debate over climate disruption, how big it will be, how inevitable it will be, how soon it will be, and has focused far too little attention upon the positive things that the world has, over the course of the last century and a half, really evolved into a place that is entirely fueled by the consumption of fossil fuels, which, in addition to its climate impact, has myriad other horrible economic, societal, cultural, pollutant, public health impacts, and that this provides real opportunities to build a different kind of economy based upon the super-efficient use of renewable energy resources, and to do that in a fashion that promotes unexportable jobs. And if you're going to be erecting wind turbines in Wyoming or you're going to put solar panels on a roof, neither of those things can be done in East Asia.
So their effort to really expand the frame of this discussion from climate change and global warming out to sort of a more American framework of sustainability is perhaps what they're trying to create.
Yes, I think that at least in this part of their message, what they're saying is that you have to pay attention to what an audience will listen to. And if what you're talking, for the most part, if your focus is catastrophist, it's the melting of the Antarctic ice and the raising of the world's oceans, the flooding of Florida and Bangladesh and the loss of the entire sort of big chunks of the eastern seaboard. And you throw in a few hurricanes and droughts and floods. It's a great movie, but it's the sort of stuff that people listen to and think, my God, that is like an act of God. There's not much that I can do about that. And they tend to turn off and move on to the latest Grammy show or American Idol or whatever it is that distracts them from it. Whereas if you go in with a very positive message, say, we've got a series of technologies that are actually very attractive, and that here in the United States, with the best educated population in the world, with a huge chunk of the disposable wealth of the world, with an entrepreneurial culture, with a skilled labor force, we should be able to lead the world into this rather glorious new direction. And that's not to say that a fair number of us haven't been saying that for the last 25 century, but it's not been the core message of the environmental movement, and there's an argument that it should be, or should have been.
Certainly that is what the Palo Alliance is all about.
On the one hand, you have to acknowledge that there is some reason out there to change, but you shouldn't be fixated upon the threat. You should be fixated upon the solution. And I think that just makes common sense in all sorts of political ways, and it also draws a relatively clean distinction between the policies that are being pursued by the current administration in Washington, D.C., and the policies that are being pursued in other countries around the world. You know, the American taxpayers paid for the development of photovoltaic arrays. We put them on space stations. We've had the National Renewable Energy Laboratory doing a huge amount of fundamental research on probably a dozen different compound semiconductors in different ways and different forms to use silicon. And we basically walked away from that huge amount of technological wealth. Last year, one company in Japan manufactured half of all the photovoltaic arrays in the world. The Japanese industry produced the vast majority of them, followed by Europe, followed in a very, very, very distant third by the United States. The one remaining significant, although small, photovoltaic company in the United States, Evergreen Solar, has just announced that it's going to be building in a joint venture, a large new manufacturing facility, but it's placing it in Germany, where the government has created a market for this technology. I mean, this is just crazy, and we ought to be saying, we can do that, we can do it better, we can do it cheaper, we can do it faster here in the United States. But that's just not happening here.
So why aren't we? I mean, you're absolutely right. I agree with everything you said, and then we have to ask the question, why is this not happening here? It makes perfect sense. The message of the Apollo Alliance to really create essential energy independence or some variation thereof within 10 years is something that almost everybody who hears that message welcomes and understands and gets. But why is it that it is so difficult to really make it mainstream?
Well, let me address this with care, which I hope won't make it too boring, but because if I do it non-boring, it sounds conspiratorial, and there's nothing at all conspiratorial about it. It's very upfront and open. There are powerful economic interests, and they are consolidated in the oil and gas industries and the coal industry, which are basically American creations, and in the public utility industry, that do not want to see this happen. With the oil and other fossil fuel industries, it's because as you move away from them and into flows of energy from the sun, suddenly all of their multiple tens of billions of dollars of investments become worth very much less. Assuming that we create a system in which these renewables do in fact either drive out or price the others out of the marketplace. Similarly with utilities, because the most attractive of these renewable technologies manufacture electricity, and you're going to be sending that through the grid. You're going to be either storing it in batteries or converting water into hydrogen and oxygen and then recombining it later in a fuel cell to let you have some energy later when the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't shining. All of that is a vast, complicated new maneuver that the utility industry doesn't know how to do. It does know how to do what it's been doing successfully for the last century, and it's huge, bureaucratic, and enormously resistant to change, and has employees and voters in communities, every single community across the landscape. And when you add them together, the utility industry is by far the largest set of capital investments in the American economy. The oil industry has by far the largest revenues in the American economy. They are both very skillful and adept political players, and they haven't wanted this to happen. And to some very great extent, they have had control over the committees of Congress and the appointees to the Department of Energy to ensure that it doesn't happen. So it's happening elsewhere in the world, and eventually, instead of exporting these things, we're going to be importing them. So unless we change direction. I mean, that, and what I just did was exactly what the death of environmentalists say. You stop there and you take this enormously bleak picture, and frankly, there's no reason that it needs to be a bleak picture. We still have, scattered in universities across the country and in the superb scientific staff at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, the core of expertise that would allow us to leap rather rapidly again into global leadership if we had the national commitment and the money available for it.
Is part of the difficulty in this debate the term environmentalism?
Well, maybe. I tend to be somewhat less concerned by these, what seem to me somewhat ephemeral public opinion surveys of how words are responded to by people. But it is clear that at least in the last little fleck in the last few years, while people continue to be, by and large, very enthusiastic about protecting the environment, they are substantially less enthusiastic, as measurable by a dozen or more points in public opinion surveys, about environmentalists and environmentalism. So if we can protect the environment without environmentalists doing it, maybe that is a desirable thing. I think this is just one of those little quivers that happens in charts when a few prominent people say some things that alienate other people, and in the great sweep of history, I expect, just as there will continue to be civil rights advocates and there will continue to be feminist advocates and peace advocates and what have you, social justice, human rights, environmental advocates will continue to play a very important role in America's future as well.
Therefore, you believe that environmentalism is not dead, that it does have a future?
I think that there's a paper ready to be written that's, I hope I don't offend any of the religious sensibilities in your audience, but the resurrection of environmentalism. I mean, it headed down a pathway that caused its focus to be too much on the negative side and insufficiently upon the positive alternatives. And I think it's healthy that we've had this debate, and I think we're going to be seeing signs of people much more focusing upon not just the threats that we face, not just what we're trying to stop, but the affirmative visions of a society that all of us would really like to raise our children in.
So I'm just curious if there are words that possibly you think may work better or feel better, or that we might look at into the future. Because it kind of is a debate about words, really.
No, I think we really need to work at the substance beneath the words and what it stands for, and the words will ultimately come to mean what their principal proponents want them to mean. I mean, if you look at, say, the word that is most ascendant today, probably, in American politics, conservatism, I think we were probably both old enough in 1964 when Barry Goldwater went down in flames, got maybe one-third of the votes in a presidential election, and in intellectual circles, conservatives were almost uniformly thought of as Neanderthals dragging their knuckles across the ground and talking about bombing Vietnam back to the Stone Age and expressing views that were frankly blatantly racist. And people who had clever new ways to use the market to achieve some good things began to redefine what conservatism meant and began to think in terms that actually created some relatively creative ideas about ways to approach problems. That all sort of culminated in Newt Gingrich and the contract with America in 1994, sort of 30 years later, in a situation that now has conservative forces in charge of the House of Representatives, the Senate, the White House, the full administration, and the federal judiciary. You know, the words words are not our problem. And I think the environment, candidly, is a very good word for what it is that we're trying to talk about, which is to recognize that the Earth as a whole is interrelated, functions as a broad biological system, that we are part of that system, and that the principles that govern, the broad ecological principles that govern how you have a sustainable population of elk, or a sustainable population of wolves, or a sustainable population of orcas, those broad principles apply to all of the animals on Earth, including human beings. We have some very, very important elements that are not with creatures that don't have opposable thumbs and sort of large frontal lobes, but still bringing principles of ecological design to our cities and to our industries, I think, is a crucial element of having a sustainable, healthy, attractive future for our children and grandchildren. I don't want to run away from that vocabulary.
Dennis Hayes, president of the Bullitt Foundation, I want to thank you so much for giving your thoughts on the future of environmentalism, and let's continue our conversation again.
Good, Sydney. Thanks for calling.
We're talking with Doug Scott with the Campaign for America's Wilderness. Doug, you've weighed in on this debate that is raging in the environmental community. Is environmentalism dead? I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, first, just for context, I have been a part of the active environmental movement on the national scene and locally around the country since well before the original Earth Day. And I know Dennis Hayes may be one of your guests, and Dennis was the fellow that organized the original Earth Day, hired for that purpose by the board of directors chaired by Gaylord Nelson, and I was one of the student members of that board, so I have a connection to this movement that goes back a long ways. I believe that once again we are going to have a flurry of assertions and broad sweeping generalizations that environmentalism is dead. It's not the first, won't be the last. I find it bordering on tedious debate, because it has nothing to do with the real world in which I live. I travel a great deal. I hang around with public land and wilderness preservation and forest reform groups around the country. I have just within the last month been across Idaho in Boise and in small towns. I have been across three major communities in Montana. The health of at least this part of the broad conservation movement working to see better management of public land resources and forests, working to see wiser use of water, greater protection of wildlife, and preservation of additional wilderness areas. The health of that wilderness movement at the grassroots of that public land movement is as good as it has ever been. Now, these are rough times, and so the context in which we seek these goals, and grassroots groups like the Montana Wilderness Association, the Idaho Conservation League, the Washington Wilderness Coalition, the kind of groups, the Sky Island Alliance, who I'll be visiting next week in Tucson, these groups are hard at work. They have resources. They have respect and strong ties in their local communities. The Montana Wilderness Association has more financial resources, has doubled its membership in the last 3 years, had over 500 paid registrants at its most recent annual convention in December. It's on a roll. Now, in our society at the moment, some environmental issues are extremely hard fought, and they have endless money and resources. And they're getting cleverer all the time. They can throw advertising money that the environmental movement does not have at these issues. And some of these issues are very hard pressed. Only if the American people rise up again and speak out as they have in the past, will we see the completely unnecessary oil drilling threat in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge can be turned back again, but only if people speak up. So the point, I guess, that I want to make is that I think sweeping generalizations at the level of is environmentalism dead, just whistling in the graveyard in a completely, in a way that just doesn't connect to the universe I see out there across this country.
They raise the issue from the perspective of the failure of the quote-unquote environmental community to address the climate issue and global warming. How are we going to resolve this? Because certainly there is some truth to that, how do we resolve sort of the on-the-ground environmental movement with this larger context, which is kind of what they're trying to address?
I find that the people that I naturally tend to visit as I do my travels and come to talks that I give or book signings for my new book on wilderness preservation, history, and politics, want to talk about global warming, want to talk about this outrageous clear skies, phony-labeled clear skies effort to gut the Clean Air Act in a way that is unchanged from over the years. And people of environmental concern share a wide variety of concerns. Now, global warming comes at fundamentals of the existing industrial complex and asks that industrial complex across the entire planet to undertake a series of fundamental changes and reorientations that most of those enterprises don't wish to do. It will impose expenses. There's broad concern about what's going on with at the level of our global climate. So the issue of global warming takes on a larger swath of, asks for a large degree of economic and social change than nearly anything that the environmental agenda has embraced previously. It should not be surprising that it's difficult. It comes at a time when a president of the United States willfully wishes to pretend the problem would go away or didn't exist or is still a subject of respectable scientific debate, which it's not. It hasn't been for quite a while, and that makes it harder. But that just means it's time to roll up our sleeves and work harder and engage more people and educate more people and talk to the neighborhood level and right up to the national dialogue. And I know mass numbers of people are doing that kind of work, and they're not going to be discouraged by a basically esoteric philosophical discussion about whether somehow or other. I guess I'm offended by the phraseology. It makes a cute soundbite. Is environmentalism dead? And it's a nice debater's point. But I think there's so much more serious work to be done to deal with issues like global warming that need to be done with all the focus and energy and creativity that talented people can bring to it, and I just hate to see any element of the existing environmental movement get very distracted. Of course we ought to constantly, all of us, be re-examining our fundamentals and be looking for better and more effective ways to do our work and to engage the American people in these issues. But like any other social movement made up of fallible human beings, the environmental movement makes errors on a little individual. There are setbacks. This is nothing new. But my belief is that there is great concern and great support for doing things about issues like global warming out there, being repressed at this point by national leadership at the political level, which would rather bury its head in the sand. But once again, that is a call for the people to lead until the leaders catch up with us.
I know some people are suggesting that the word environment carries quite a political weight, and there's discussions of possibly rephrasing that to re-embrace the concept of conservation. How does that fly by you?
Well, that is one of the oldest go-arounds in the whole subject matter. Sometimes we're the conservation movement, sometimes we're the environmental movement, and of course, what's encompassed within those phrases is very broad. I frankly don't think it amounts to a hill of beans. We live in a sophisticated public relations society today in which words, you know, the president has figured out that referring to fiddling with Social Security in fundamental ways by referring to private accounts doesn't cut it. You know, only their pollsters have looked at that in great detail, and so now the word private is suddenly banned in everything they say, and they're trying to get us all to think of it as personal accounts, which somehow or other is supposed to feel more warm and cozy. Environmentalists, conservationists, we will be successful as groups and movements as and people if we talk about the values that people care about, the future for themselves and their kids and their grandkids in a healthy environment that will sustain a quality of life that many people feel is slipping away. If we are, in our massively increasing population and economic drive, if we are polluting the nest which we depend upon, we have to clean up our act. And I think there's great public fundamental support for that. It's not something we should take for granted, but we need to be very cautious in sweeping generalizations about the status and politics of what is in fact not one great national movement. You know, if you wanted to change the name from the environmental movement to the conservation movement or aardvark movement tomorrow, you would be basically, who's going to do that? A lot of the groups that I work with aren't waiting for the national leadership of anything to tell them what the word of the day is. They're too busy working on these issues.
That's a wonderful point. And you are on the ground. That's one thing I know about Doug Scott. You're out there working every single day of your
life. I've been on the ground with environmental conservation, hunting, fishing, and public land groups in 30 states in the last 6 months.
Well, perhaps this debate will empower us to really unite and move forward more united into the future.
Well, and if it also explains to us that after a few minutes of indulging in a debate at this level of generality, we get back to work, that would be by far the best possible outcome, and work smarter, harder, engage more people at the neighbor-to-neighbor across-the-fence kind of conversation that actually enlists people. It was that infectious spirit that these issues could be influenced by normal people, ordinary, everyday people, that led to the huge surge of energy around the original Earth Day in April of 1970. I have seen that work again and again. I know a woman who is a cocktail waitress in a small town casino in rural Nevada who has seen the President of the United States, this President, George W. Bush, sign into law 3 years ago and then again last year two different laws that protected wilderness areas on the public lands in her state that she was a leader on. And I know too many stories about that kind of impact that ordinary people who get engaged in our democracy can bring about. And it's I'm impatient with this debate, because it seems to me to have, while it may lead to some sharpening of concepts and thinking, it is also an enormous time sink that distracts leaders from what they should be doing, which is leading.
Doug Scott, thank you so much for your thoughts on this, and I hope we can have a chance to talk again about many more things.
Great.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
And now I'm talking with David Johns, who is president of the board of the Wildlands Project, an organization that a lot of you are going to want to know a lot more about, and many of you do already know about. He's also professor of politics at Portland State University in Portland, Oregon. David, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You've been following this debate, and you teach politics. Your perspective would be very welcome. So let's first of all get your reactions.
Well, first of all, I welcome the debate. I have a couple of thoughts about the paper and also about what I consider to be the two biggest obstacles that conservationists or environmentalists face, and I frankly think a lot more about conservation, the protection of wildlife, of ecosystems, than some of the other issues. That's my emphasis, just so your listeners know that.
You know, David, give us a little heads up on the Wildlands Project, because not everybody knows. That will help frame your discussion better.
Well, sure. The Wildlands Project is an effort to create a system of connected protected areas across North America that would be capable of supporting all native species, all ecological processes in perpetuity. So what we're really trying to do is figure out how best to protect and recover the biological health of North America, and to try to ensure that that continues. That involves, of course, not only understanding the biological science, but also trying to understand the political science of accomplishing these goals.
You're literally aiming for an unbroken biome between Canada and Mexico.
Well, we work throughout North America, so we work really from the Arctic all the way down to Mesoamerica. We recognize that ecological systems and ecological integrity and the survival of species depends on protecting things at lots of different scales. So species, individual animals, individual communities, but those communities are also interrelated, and even continents, we're finding out, are in a sense systems themselves, as well as, of course, the globe in its entirety. So it's really important to try to understand what's going on at all of these different levels and the way they interpenetrate, and to try to problem solve then at the appropriate level.
Well, of course, the paper raises the issue that the environmental organizations in the United States are failing to a large degree. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I certainly agree that we are nowhere near achieving what we need to achieve to be moving in the right direction. The environmental movement, the conservation movement, while we certainly have won some battles, I think we are losing the war. In some sense, that's not unique, I think, to the United States, although things are very, very bad here right now, given the particular political dynamic of the last few years. I think, you know, one of the values of this paper has been, I think, to get people talking and to point out the fact that sometimes we don't think deeply enough about the roots of the problems we are confronting. I see two main obstacles to progress in conservation. The first is a material obstacle, and that is that human beings for several thousand years now have committed themselves to the massive transformation of nature to support more human beings and to support higher levels of consumption. And we've created a set of institutions which are directed at growth, at transforming and changing nature to meet human wants. I won't say human needs, but certainly human wants. And certainly the anti-conservation movement takes tremendous advantage of this initiative, of this inertia. They're simply an extension of it, and they have all the resources of these institutions essentially at their beck and call to stand out in front of that inertia, if you will, to try to slow it and ultimately reverse it, is not a small task. We're talking about basic structural change, and that is certainly what's going to be required. And certainly the authors of the paper are quite right that no technical fix is going to work. The second major obstacle we face, I believe, is cultural. It's true that one needs vision, one needs an alternative to the existing visions, and certainly those opposed to conservation have been very good at creating a vision that appeals to people, but again, they're essentially tapping into the status quo, and that's a very powerful resource. They're essentially telling people what they want to hear, which is you can have your cake and eat it too, and it's okay for us to sort of behave in an irresponsible manner toward the ecological systems which support us. Conservationists and environmentalists have then a very difficult task, which is to create an alternative vision and to ask people to make some changes, and probably in some sense the most difficult change is to ask people to behave more responsibly. And you know, anytime you're asking people to change, to ask them to consider the unfamiliar, I always think back to our own Declaration of Independence and what Thomas Jefferson wrote about the way in which people are inclined to put up with bad relationships because they're familiar and are very reticent to make, at that time, what he considered to be revolutionary changes. But that's exactly, of course, what he and others were calling upon Americans to do. And people don't do that. People don't do that lightly.
What would you say would be the points that you feel offer the greatest insight into making these changes from the paper itself?
Well, I think they do recognize, I think very importantly, the need to look broadly, to look deeply, to challenge Americans and others more about these issues. Where I think they sort of overstate their case is they seem to not recognize that many groups do this. There's a lot more variety within the conservation movement than I think they give the conservation movement credit for. So I think they're certainly on the right track in that sense. But I think we need to go beyond. You know, they speak a great deal about the need for new values and a new vision, but almost invariably they seem to be talking about the cognitive. And I think that in itself is a real severe limitation. You know, the word emotion and the word motivate both come from the same root, which is to move. And I believe to be successful, what environmentalists need to do, what conservationists need to do, is to touch people's emotions, to touch their feelings. That's what moves people, not simply statements of value, not simply painting particular pictures of things, but to truly connect with people. People care for things. They will act on behalf of themselves, of their families, of other living things when they feel connected to them. And it's that connectivity, not just connectivity across the landscape, if you will, but connectivity of the human heart to nature that conservationists really need to help rekindle. The other thing that they point out is that we don't understand our audiences very well. And this is something that has been of long concern to me, and I think to many others. Too often we talk to other audiences, people we'd like to get involved in the conservation movement, as if they were just like us. And people are not all the same. There's a lot of variety out there in terms of what motivates people, what stimulates their feelings, those kinds of things. And we really need to pay attention to that and to understand what motivates people, so we can speak to them in a language that that they understand.
You're one who champions the idea that we really must use the right story. You've been working on this. What kind of quote-unquote stories do you feel are effective?
Well, again, that's a big question. I think that every society, every group in society has a familiar group of stories that they use to explain and understand the world. We sort of navigate the world through stories. And one important first step in speaking to any group of people is to understand what their existing stories are, and to try to examine ways in which what we're talking about makes sense in terms of the stories they're already telling themselves. It's not so much that we need to always invent new stories, but simply understanding existing stories and the way in which they're interpreted. I think if we look at the most recent presidential election, in which both sides had just about the same amount of money, but one thing that one side had that the other side didn't have was a coherent story about who they were and about what they wanted, and that generated great appeal. Well, the other side, John Kerry in this case, really lacked a coherent story. A lot of talk about the issues, but no capacity to really paint a picture of the world in which people could easily find themselves.
If you could begin the writing of that story, how have you explored this? Where have you gone with this? What is this story that you think may work to connect us in our emotions, and our heart, and our vision, and our sense of well-being to this larger context of nature and then the environment?
Well, I think I'm not, there's perhaps an irony here, Sydney, in that while I recognize the value of stories, I may not be the world's best storyteller.
Yes.
By any means, so you and your listeners will have to bear with me. But I think the main story is one of empathy. The main story is one that allows human beings to see the world around them as not something different, not something that's sort of out there that they simply exploit or transform, but that nature is really part of what we need to consider our community, our home. And just as we take care of our home and we wouldn't, knock out a wall to take the 2x4s, to throw in the fireplace to stay warm for 15 minutes, we shouldn't treat nature that way. We shouldn't treat nature that way anyway. That ultimately it leaves us in a bad place. Ultimately, materially, we exhaust ecosystems, but it also leaves us very separated and alienated and not at home in the world that we are very much a part of. We've separated ourselves. It's the old word, alienation. I think a few years back to an NPR story in which Timothy Ferris, the astronomer, was asked why he thought people were so supportive of space exploration. And he said he thought, well, it was because people wanted to know whether or not they were really alone. And my first reaction to that was, how could anybody think they're alone? We're surrounded by life. Yet many, many people do feel alone, and they find themselves gazing out at the stars, wondering whether they're alone and ignoring all the life around them. And I think the reason they're able to ignore that life around them is they don't see, they don't feel the linkages. They've been cut off. The empathy is no longer there. Things become objects.
I think we need to really craft our story. David Johns, I really want to thank you for giving your thoughts here on the Wild Side News. David Johns is with the Wildlands Project. Dave, tell people how our listeners can find you.
We're on the web at www.wildlandsproject.org. That's probably the easiest. The mailing address is P.O. Box 455, Richmond, Vermont, 05477.
Is environmentalism dead?
No.
Maybe better crafting of language.
Among other things, yes. I think the article was, again, meant to get people's attention, and that it did.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you, David, for being on the show.
Thank you.
I'd like to welcome Chip Ward now to the Wild Side News. Chip is an urban librarian, author, and in particular his most recent book, Hope's Horizon, published by the Island Press, the wonderful Island Press, really takes an historical perspective on the emergence of an environmental movement. Chip, you've had a chance to really look at this ongoing debate. I welcome your thoughts.
Well, I think that the authors have overstated the case. I think that environmentalism, even if we're just referring to the large beltway national groups, is not dead. Overweight, out of shape, in need of a good workout, perhaps, but they're playing defense, and I have to tell you, we need defense at this point, and I'm thankful for that. It's kind of hard to criticize somebody about not watering their garden when their house is on fire. The natural thing is to carry water to the flames. If you expand that definition of environmentalism, though, it includes an awful lot of groups at the grassroots level that are very visionary, are engaged in bold projects, are doing a lot of very interesting things, and who are trying to reframe a lot of these issues that we're looking at. I think it's important for funders to take a second look at where their money is going. So often the large groups demand so many resources that the smaller groups that are engaged in more creative work do get kind of starved out. The Wildlands Project, for example, which I wrote about in Hope's Horizon, I think was working very hard to build intellectual capacity into the movement, to get a bolder vision going, and to unite a lot of the different things that are going on in the conservation movement. And they've fallen on hard times. So maybe a redistribution of the wealth is in order, but geez, you know, just because you want to ride fresh horses doesn't mean you have to shoot the one that's under you. I mean, obviously the authors were being very provocative, and deliberately so. And of course, if you provoke people, then you can't really be surprised if someone like Carl Pope replies and calls you out and scolds you. I hope that after the yelling calms down, that this is a useful dialogue, because I think that it's one that we need to have. You know, my own experience here in Utah, working primarily with grassroots organizations, is that they are underfunded and they do a lot of creative, catalytic work that really is important. It's important to play defense, but it's also important to nurture inspiration and the future.
In terms of defining this term environmentalism, part of the problem may be in sort of an overreach, a suggestion that environmentalism is dead. How would you define environmentalism so that we can usefully address this particular topic?
Well, you know, it's a catch-all term, and it's problematic. And I have to tell you quite honestly that I don't like the term very much. You have to remember, I live and work here in Utah, where the term is pronounced environmentalism as if it's a psychological disorder, which is suffered logically enough by environmentalists. And more often than not, when I've heard the term, it's either been used on me as an accusation by others, or as an easy way to pigeonhole and label me, and not necessarily in a flattering way. I also am troubled by the idea that at this point, I've met very few people who don't believe in having clean air, clean water, clean food, and the kind of public health that goes with a healthy environment. And so perhaps at this point we need to come up with different terms that express what we're after here. You know, I think that just about everybody I meet believes in the wisdom of protecting children through child labor laws, and yet nobody refers to themselves as a wobbly. All the women I know believe that they should be given equal pay for equal work, and they avoid relationships with males who are, you know, dominating and abusive, but they don't necessarily refer to themselves as feminists. So I think that maybe we need to get beyond that. And I don't have the answer for that, but I think that it's a useful discussion.
Let's investigate some options. Everyone's talking about framing these days. There's two things I'd like you to think about. And first of all, are there other concepts or words? Because you are a word crafter. You're a very articulate man. You also have a terrific perspective. Bring those two together and come up with some possible words that might be useful, not necessarily to replace, but to embellish the concept.
You know, Sydney, I don't know that I'm going to be too helpful in terms of global terms that everybody can use. I can tell you that based on my own experience here in Utah, we created and named two different organizations, and we were careful about how we did that. When we were opposing the incineration of chemical weapons and trying to talk about the public health issues that go with that, we named our group Families Against Incinerator Risk, and we very deliberately put the word families in there because we understood that people who have historically have become ill here through military testing, their exposure to military testing, there's a huge impact on families and loved ones and community, and we wanted to express that. We also wanted the acronym to be FAIR, and that was because very often in environmental discussions about pollution, we talk about risk, and the discussion seemed to get taken over by so-called experts who calculate risk as if it's a math problem. What we wanted to indicate is that risk isn't a math problem. Risk is about who is put at risk, for whose benefit, and whether that distribution of liabilities and benefits is fair. So we named our organization FAIR. The successor organization was called the Healthy Environment Alliance of Utah. We specifically wanted to keep the word against out of that. We wanted to say we're for something, which is a healthy environment, and that it's an alliance. It's a collaborative effort. And, of course, the acronym was HEAL. I think that, you know, it's okay to come up with a global term that everybody feels comfortable with, but really politics is played out at the local level, and a lot of these issues really get labeled locally, and we need to do a better job at that as well.
Certainly some of the geniuses at word crafting, for example, in the current White House, apply this approach all the time and very effectively. That is to create the proper wording, and perhaps Schellenberger and Nordhaus are truly encouraging us to at least rethink that and utilize better framing and wording. Any ideas on how we may reframe this? You've talked to a lot of environmental people, and I'm just curious, you know, what you think they're thinking about this debate.
Well, I can tell you as an activist who tries to motivate people to reach goals that you really can only go so far with guilt, fear, and outrage and obligation. They'll motivate you over the short term, but people burn out when that's what's pushing them. People really do need inspiration. They need positive goals. They need catalytic visions. The Apollo Project is one of those, and oddly enough, the authors point to that as an example of a more expansive agenda, and yet most of the people that they're criticizing in groups were very involved in that project. I find that kind of thing exciting because I think that you can only motivate people so long to be against something, but boy, if you give them a vision, they're much more likely to stay in it for the long run. I like that idea that, you know, Martin Luther King said, "I have a dream." He didn't say, "I have a nightmare." And certainly he could have, because the situation in our country with civil rights was a nightmare at that time. But he was wise enough to say, this is what we could be. If we work together and if we follow our ideals and if we practice our values, this could be better. I very much think we need to do better work at framing these issues, and I think that we're starting to do that, and I hope that this dialogue is a contribution to that.
As you look out, can you give examples of some projects, programs that you feel are accomplishing this effectively?
Well, I liked the Wildlands Project. I mean, it got beyond this the constant defense that we're always playing, which has to be played. It's very important. I belong to an organization, Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, that is known for its litigating and lobbying. And we have achieved at least de facto protection of millions of acres of very precious wilderness areas here in Utah by doing that, and it's important. But on the other hand, you need people to say, let's think on a broader time scale. Let's talk about not just defending those areas that are already pristine or have integrity, but let's talk about perhaps healing wounded lands, reconnecting broken and fragmented landscapes. Let's talk about putting predators back on the in the landscape and protecting them. That's the kind of positive vision that I'm talking about. I felt that the Journal of the Wildlands Project, Wild Earth, was a wonderful forum for building intellectual capacity into the movement, getting people to think of new paradigms and to expand the agenda. And unfortunately, the Wild Earth just folded. That's an example of what happens when the funding isn't there.
What do you think is the basis? I mean, why is it that environmentalism is struggling so much at this time? The concept, the movement, the term, and us.
Well, it's something that I struggle with personally. It seemed to me, I was recently debating some folks who are more representative, I think, of the George Bush right wing on some environmental issues, and it seemed to me that it was self-evident that, and in people's self-interest, that a clean and healthy environment is the basis for a sound economy, a sustainable economy, and for sustainable health. I then realized that some of these folks have a different worldview. They're actually sort of looking forward to the apocalypse. They believe that biblical prophecy will come true, that the righteous are going to be lifted into heaven. And so when I say, geez, you're heading for a very self-destructive path, they don't really share that point of view. So I think I need to think more about that. I think that we need to give young people more opportunities to connect to the land. Almost everybody I've met who is involved in environmental activism can point to an experience in childhood when they were playing in a brook or a meadow or a favorite place or went on a trip, and they had some kind of experience in the natural world that affected them deeply. And I'm afraid that fewer and fewer people are getting that. So I think that we need to work on our future cadre by giving children more opportunities for that. I mean, everybody wants a computer in the classroom. Nobody's talking about putting gardens in there. Children learn about how to balance the books. They don't ever do any bird watching. We need to start building that into our consciousness for the long run. Other than that, Sydney, I'm an activist at heart, and my philosophy is basically you start many fires, and most of them go out, and when they don't, you blow on them. And so I'm not at all worried about trying many, many different things and sometimes failing. I think that that's part of the process of building a creative movement that will last. Sydney, it's interesting that we, those of us who feel that we have some affinity and understanding of the natural world, very much respect diversity. We see it as a way that nature is resilient and as a sign of health. I think diversity within our own movement is also important and can also be tolerated. Many different paths are available to us, and we should try as many as we can.
To a large extent, what we're talking about is somehow healing some sort of unique rift that's happening, possibly because of the sense of defeat. I think that's part of this. We're kind of licking our wounds right now. If you were to look out and sort of envision an American environmental movement, which is kind of what we have to craft in America, and then, of course, there's the global environmental movement. But part of our problem, and certainly what Schellenberger and Nordhaus opened in terms of a debate, was the fact that we're failing at the global level as well in terms of global warming, which is an enormous challenge. How do we unite an American vision and as well a global vision?
Well, I don't have an answer. I don't have a formula. I don't have an equation, and I don't have something that I could easily summarize or convey. I think that you roll up your sleeves and you're determined to do it, and you start doing it, and you start talking about how to do it. And this is part of the process. I think one of the things that this debate has made evident is that we often in the environmental so-called environmental movement, conservation movement, don't have good forums for discussing these things, and we need to create that. And I hope that that's what we're doing, perhaps on the Wildside News or in Grist Magazine. And that's part of the process as well. You know, when we talk about the failure to deal with global warming and so forth, I think in America we're certainly failing to do that. When I look to Europe, I see that they're much farther ahead than us. They're starting to implement the precautionary principle. They seem to acknowledge global warming. They seem to be making commitments a lot easier than we do. And let's not forget that it's not just the environmental side here in America that's failing. We're not doing very well in terms of civil liberties. We're not doing very well in terms of taking care of the poor among us. There's a lot of progressive issues and a lot of important issues where we're also falling down and failing. It's not just on the environmental side.
Looking out 10 years, are you hopeful?
I am always hopeful. I don't think hope is an accident or an attitude. I think hope is a choice. Very often it's what you choose to look at. You can look at the defeats, you can look at the frustrations, and you certainly need to do that and be mindful. I don't want to be Pollyanna here, but on the other hand, we do need to look at some of the progress we've made. I got a collection of books the other day from a patron at our library who wanted to donate them. They were books from the 1950s on forest management, wildlife management, and so forth. I went through the index looking for common terms that we all use today, like niche, habitat, keystone species, and so forth, and I was amazed. I couldn't find any of those terms in there. We've had really a revolution in how we understand our place in the world. The fact that we are reintroducing wolves into Western landscapes is amazing. Our grandparents would have found that unfathomable. The fact that we are talking about the precautionary principle, which is a revolutionary idea that puts the burden of proof on industry and corporations rather on victims who live downwind. These are all important developments, and they're significant. We shouldn't ignore that we have some success as well. As a librarian, which is the other hat I wear in life, we believe just very strongly in the importance of civic dialogues, of people being inclusive and open as they talk to each other. And I think that, again, after the yelling has ended here on this debate, we need to have some serious discussions, and we need to do it in a civil way. I am also sort of a refugee of the 60s, and I remember the divisive and factional arguments that went on and how people turned on one another. We need to avoid doing that. This movement not only needs to find new directions, to frame its issues differently, it also needs to learn how to talk to itself, and that's a sign of maturity, and that's part of the solution as well.
Well, that certainly is what the Wildside News and the Voice of the Earth, which is the expanded vision of the Wildside News, which you've just contributed to, is all about. Chip Ward, I want to thank you for your thoughts and sharing your wisdom on this debate on the Wildside News. Also, please give us websites that you feel people should know about.
Well, the one that I like is the local one, which is for Heal Utah, www.healutah.org, to learn about some of the issues we have here in the West about the dumping of radioactive waste and nuclear waste out here. It's a national issue, and it often takes place sort of out of sight out here in the more remote regions of the West, so I urge people to go there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sydney. It's always a pleasure.
And I would like to welcome Kathleen Rogers, president of the Earth Day Network, to the Wildside News. Kathleen, welcome.
Thank you so much. I enjoy being on your show, and I'm looking forward to this.
Great. Well, you're well aware of the debate that's going on. I'm just curious what you've heard in the environmental community following this debate that was sort of launched in October before the election last year.
Well, I was actually in Hawaii at the Environmental Grantmakers Association meeting when there was the first presentation of this article. And I think a couple of things happened. The first is there's a segment of the environmental community that viewed part of what they said as so profoundly wrong that they decided to shoot back, if you will. And there's a certain amount of circling of the wagons with some members of the environmental community and a general denial that sort of anything they said was relevant or true or should result in some self-examination. And then there's a larger segment of the environmental community that I believe really view this as an opportunity to think about the issues that they raised. But I also would say that it's not as if any of the issues that were raised hadn't been thought of before. They were all put in a particular article, a lengthy article, at one time, and so it became a little bit of an indictment of the mainstream environmental community when really many members of the environmental community had been thinking along the same lines.
So now let's bring it back to you and your thoughts.
Well, I think, you know, Earth Day Network's mission, by the way, this year is the 35th anniversary of Earth Day, so we're working very hard on a communications piece that reflects the last 35 years of the modern environmental movement. And it puts us in a unique position because we have 12,000 organizational network partners in 174 countries. So we hear a lot and do a lot in many different quarters of the world. And I think it is important to recognize that outside of the United States, for the most part, and particularly in the developing world, environmental organizations don't really have the luxury of just being environmental organizations. They are community development groups, sustainable development groups, women's groups, they're all rolled into one because they don't have that specialized, highly focused commitment. So, for example, in the United States, some groups work on wilderness, some groups work on endangered species. It's very focused on particular and sometimes narrow issues. So outside the U.S., it's a different model. And what we're hoping, and I think part of the result of this article, is that more and more people will recognize that environment really is much more, I mean, the general public, I hope they'll recognize that environment means much more than land conservation, endangered species protection, ecosystems management, all very important things, but that to be relevant and thriving and robust, we must focus on issues that impact ordinary people. And Earth Day Network's mission, both in the U.S. and outside the U.S., is to broaden the movement and to work with new partners, as we have been for the past couple of years with the NAACP and with ACORN and other groups that we feel bring diversity and a difference of opinion about what makes communities work. So we're drawing together a lot of really good thinking on sort of from the ground up. And that way we can build a more progressive, forward-thinking society than we have now in the U.S., one that's focused on environmental protection, but one that also recognizes that environment equals sound economic policies, environment equals your health, environment equals your quality of life, environment equals your schools, your housing. As you know, and I think in our previous conversations I've said this, I find it 35 years after the first Earth Day almost outrageous that we're spending so much money, billions and billions on bottled water when we spent $1 trillion+ to clean up our water. And that was one of the first things that really happened in a big way after the first Earth Day. And on the other hand, you have this sort of dichotomy in our society where 90% of people can consider themselves to be environmentalists but don't really understand the ramifications of driving singly to work or wasting natural resources, whatever the issue might be. So we definitely have a little bit of a schism in this country between what environment means and how we practice it.
I know some people have commented that part of the difficulty is just the association with the word environmentalist, and that there's some baggage there that is difficult for sort of a broad mainstream America to feel comfortable with.
I believe you're right, absolutely right, and I don't think it's a fault of our own. Certainly, we have many special interests within the environmental community, for example, endangered species or clean water or toxic cleanup. But it, I think we need to do a better job in our messaging and our framing of our issues before we're outgunned and outmaneuvered by people who know that we can be marginalized by just saying a few bad words. And so it's incumbent on us to look at articles like the one, The Death of Environmentalism, and polling and other things to find ways that we can make better alliances with different progressive organizations and movements, but not just stopping there. I mean, for example, we are reaching out to evangelicals to do an Earth Day Sunday this year, and Black Baptists and rabbis to do something, encourage people to do things in their home, because Passover is the first day, is the day after Earth Day. But we're also talking to corporations and to middle-class Americans, where we feel we have the most to gain by talking to them in terms that they recognize and appreciate.
So is environmentalism dead?
Oh, no. You know, Earth Day makes that so abundantly clear to me, because we do big events, and we're doing them all over the world this year in honor of Earth Day. But we are overwhelmed with regular, everyday people who aren't involved in movement building, that are doing thousands, tens of thousands of small events or cleanups in this country, whether it's K-12 teachers or community groups or the Army or the National Park Service or a local park or a church group. People are doing environmental cleanup, community development actions every single day, and they use Earth Day in the most wonderful ways. And environmentalism isn't dead. I think, again, it's really related to how we counter in a productive way what the forces of evil, so to speak, would like the world to believe about what an environmentalist is. But you can't tell a K-12 teacher, a third grade teacher in Omaha, Nebraska, that she's not an environmentalist, or a fireman who's doing a cleanup of a riverbank in Austin, Texas, that he's not an environmentalist. And you can't tell a Baptist minister who makes an Earth Day sermon available to his congregation about ways a community can save themselves that environmentalism is dead. It's not.
Within the environmental community, which is kind of where this debate is taking place, it certainly doesn't seem to be reaching the mainstream very much. Not much in the environmental community reaches the mainstream these days, which is part of the problem. Within that community, how will this debate shape the future?
I think it can only help. Even those organizations that responded angrily to the article are facing, and have actually already faced, what it means to build broader alliances with groups other than other members of the environmental community. That was an ongoing activity that most groups who care about their future have already started to contemplate and put into action. I think there were some very, very interesting points raised in that article that we haven't collectively addressed and need to do so. Diversity is one, reaching to groups that over to groups that have seemingly nothing in common with us, and building alliances. Now, the Apollo Project, which they mentioned a couple of times in the article, is a good example, but there are many, many others. I mean, the Apollo Alliance is a combination of environmental groups and unions. Well, that's been going on forever, and the same environmental groups that were indicted in that article are actually part of the Apollo Alliance. So in that sense, the article didn't really make any sense to me, because you can't point to the Apollo Project as being forward-thinking, but at the same time not recognizing that what makes the Apollo Project real is the fact that I think at least 17 environmental groups, most of the big ones, had signed on to it over a year and a half ago. So using that as an example of what's right versus what's wrong with the mainstream environmental community is really straw man, because they're all part of the Apollo Alliance.
Kathleen, as you look at the 35th anniversary of Earth Day, what do you think is the key moment that you're hoping to achieve?
Well, that's a very important question. Our goal this year is to demonstrate the diversity of the environmental movement, and also to demonstrate both nationally and globally that we are working on a broad set of issues, and that broad set of issues is the environment. And one of the ways we've done that is to go back not only to 1970 and what drew 20 million people out into the streets, but also look at the very sort of Webster's dictionary definition of environmentalism or environment, which is what surrounds you. And we are focused on what surrounds people, whether they're people, the urban poor, whether they're the middle class, whether they're in developing countries. Environment starts with what surrounds you. And if what surrounds you isn't healthy and isn't productive and isn't safe, then those are the issues that we're going to tackle. So for us, it's important for everybody to recognize that from the ground up, to build a global commons and a sense of responsibility for climate change or for dwindling water resources or for children's health, that we have to start at home. And it's easy to do because that is the definition of environment.
And for people who want to learn more about the Earth Day Network?
Well, we can start with logging onto our website, which has been extremely active for the last couple of months. It's amazing. We've had to minimize our graphics to take care of the traffic. But we're also launching a new website on March 1st, and there'll be a lot of information not only on events in communities that we're involved with, but I hope thousands of events that are taking place without any help from us at all. And we hope they'll all be there, both in the U.S. and globally, very soon.
So if people want to visit the virtual Earth Day Network, where should they go?
It's earthday.net or earthday.org.
Very good. Well, Kathleen Rogers, president of the Earth Day Network, I want to thank you so much for giving your thoughts about this important moment in the environmental future.
Well, thank you. You have a terrific program, and so I'm glad to be part of it.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So now I want to welcome to the Wild Side News Jeff DeBelko with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He is the director of the Environmental Change and Security Program. Jeff, welcome to our show.
Thanks so much, Sidney.
You've been following the debate, is environmentalism dead? You've been involved in environmental work for a very long time. First of all, why don't you tell us about the nature of your work, and then let's get your thoughts on this issue.
Sure. We here at the Wilson Center are actually the official memorial to Woodrow Wilson, and we try to get together the worlds of research and scholarship with the worlds of policy, and particularly try to do that with some communities that don't often talk. Environmentalists, people working on health issues and demography issues, and we try to get them together with folks with broader portfolios in foreign policy and even security policy. And we find that although these groups don't often talk with one another, there are some areas of common interest and cooperation. And so we try to get them in the room together so that we might find some more effective ways to deal with some of these really pressing global challenges that we're facing.
Well, certainly this issue is plopped right into the middle of your efforts to bring about increasing dialogue amongst people who typically don't in framing these issues. Give me your thoughts on this debate.
Mm-hmm. One reaction I had to the discussion, which is really focused in many ways on positioning the role of the environment in the politics of the United States, would be that I'd take a step back and try to ask the question as whether environmentalism is dead in the larger stage of the world and public opinion there, and would say that actually it's a much more encouraging sign if we take that larger view and broaden out the scope of the discussion. I think in Europe we see in many ways the expression of the support for climate change in the Kyoto Protocol being something that really is quite encouraging in Europe, in perhaps in contrast to the United States, at least politically from the perspective of the United States. But I think it also, would see evidence in a number of developing countries when particularly it is framed as a sustainable development agenda, that there's quite a lot of interest and support for taking these issues seriously and implementing them in day-to-day. I think part of what we've learned at the Wilson Center is that it is critical to try to engage audiences that one doesn't always work with and to think outside our common areas of our common comfort areas. in that respect. And so as much as the one message of the Death of Environmentalism report gives is to that the environmental movement needs to talk to people that we don't always talk to. And I think that does include certainly the private sector, and it does perhaps include faith-based communities. It does include talking to people at multiple levels of politics, so from the local to the state to the national, but also I would maintain more conversations internationally and understanding how people outside the United States can take these issues seriously and in some ways might help us frame the issues back here at home in more effective ways.
Why do you think that, in particular, the European environmental organizations and groups and movement are having a greater success than we are here in America, in the United States?
Well, I think part of what has happened is that environmental issues, in some sense, have not been as segmented as a specific interest or a specific set of arguments. And in fact, you see a widespread acceptance across political parties for some of these environmental assumptions. And so there's a greater integration of environmental considerations across the board politically. That has then led to a kind of a more uniform and widely accepted sense of importance for these issues. One fundamental difference, it seems to me, would be the fact that in the United States, a lot of these disputes are settled through the courts, and with a fairly litigious society that we have here in the United States, and that is just not the case to the same degree in Europe. And so there are more opportunities for cooperation between government, between the private sector, and between civil society. And so the courts, it seems to me, tend to push sides out to their extremes. Now, obviously, using the courts has been a very valuable tool of the domestic environmental movement to push government and push private sector to take aggressive actions and provide very valuable protections. But nevertheless, these may be, in some respects, part of the cost.
I think it is that litigious nature that forces what Schellenberger and Nordhaus brought up, and that is the fact that this becomes a debate of very scientific and incremental, as opposed to a larger context. It almost forces that as the means through which environmental change is manifest.
Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I mean, one can make the argument that the environmental movement, it's its own success that in part has led to some of the difficulties. So we have seen great success in dealing with many of the end-of-tailpipe point source pollution problems, and they've been dealt with in many respects. Now, obviously, we could debate about how there are attempts to roll back those protections, but in many respects, those were some of the easy battles, if we can say that. The harder questions of fundamental questions about consumption and lifestyle in terms of the transportation systems that we have, the dependence on the fossil fuel economy, these are the tougher nuts to crack that also have very set and powerful interests behind them that we've seen less progress in dealing with.
Where do you see examples of good progress in terms of creating this more sustainable society and therefore addressing the larger issue, which is global warming and climate change?
Mm-hmm. I would say that there are certainly advantages that places like the Nordic countries in Europe have. They have relatively small, affluent, and homogeneous societies that have some sense of societal consensus on being sustainable. But I do think that you are seeing a willingness to engage and take seriously renewable energy in lightening footprints in their transportation sectors, in trying to be cognizant of their larger climate impacts. Now, again, nobody's perfect. The Norwegians have the luxury of North Sea oil, which allows them to do, in many ways, be very environmentally conscious. So it's not that they're perfect and everybody else isn't. But I do think there are some places where we can see some of these technologies actually tried and to some degree subsidized by government so they can be given a chance, and that they should be signs of hope for approaches that we could take.
You've written a book called Environmental Peacemaking. That, to me, seems to be a universal that has terrific appeal, that concept. To which degree can the environment and the effort to preserve our environment really be broadened out into the concept that this will lead to peace?
The arguments that we grappled with in environmental peacemaking were premised on the notion that we have spent an awful lot of time looking at where tensions over natural resources have exacerbated conflict, whether that's actually violent conflict or more often contestation between parties. And we said we haven't spent enough time trying to understand how environment and the shared dependencies that we have by the very nature of the resources, how they can be pathways to confidence building, trust building, and hopefully peacemaking across these lines of tension. And in the book, we're actually looking at a number of different regional settings where countries do share environmental interdependencies and various ways that both governments but also civil society actors have used that interdependence and played on those environmental issues to find ways to talk and engage in dialogue that can hopefully bolster better relations in the area of the environment but also larger political relations. So in that sense, do see some kind of hopeful signs in some of these dynamics.
Do you address the issue as tensions decrease, this may free up greater funding for progressive sustainability projects and economies and things of that nature?
Well, I think that would be the hope. And in some ways, part of our argument is that governments and civil society groups haven't tried these approaches enough. So we're in some sense, not enough evidence to pass a lot of judgments. But if we look, for example, at the Nile Basin, where we have so commonly heard that the next war is not going to be over oil, it's going to be over water, and kind of the saber rattling that goes on in that region. But in fact, we've seen for, say, the past 6 or 7 years, very serious, high-level, ministerial-level negotiations where all the countries in the basin, all 10 of them, have said, let's try together to move together from arguing over our rights to water to talk about what we need the water for and hopefully end up, and in some cases with their shared vision statement, ending up with how do we share benefits? How do we take off the political boundaries as a kind of exercise in understanding how we can cooperatively use water to meet our development needs, to keep them in a sustainable development fashion, and lessen the causes of tension among the different countries, and in that way bring some of the much needed development in this poor part of the world and not have to maintain the kind of heightened security perspective that that the water wars rhetoric in fact encourages.
In that sense, environmental issues are going to become again very mainstreamed in just in terms of survival and security.
That's right.
By the way, if people wanted to find out more about your book, Environmental Peacemaking, how might they do that?
Probably best would be to go to our Environmental Change and Security Project website, which they can find at www.woodrowwilsoncenter.org/ECST.
Is environmentalism dead in your eyes?
No. No.
Has this been a useful debate?
Sure. When we challenge our basic assumptions, even if we don't agree with those challenges, forcing us to look at how we're doing business and our success and our failures is always useful. Some lessons we can take, whether we agree with the specific arguments of the authors or not, are that we need to constantly reevaluate what we're doing. We constantly need to look for new partners. We need to look for models of success outside our immediate context and try to always be looking for new opportunities and doing better.
Jeff DeBelko, I want to thank you for sharing your thoughts on the Wild Side News. Jeff DeBelko is with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, a great organization that is bringing voice, as I try as well to do, to some great minds and great new ideas that will help this planet in the future. Thanks so much, Jeff.
Thanks so much, Sid.
I'm talking with Vicki Cimarano, the Executive Director of Wild Pack. Vicki, what is Wild Pack?
Wild Pack is a political action committee that works to elect wilderness and public lands leaders at all levels of government. So in this past election, everything from president down to city or county council. Durango, Colorado.
And how can people find out more about Wild Pack?
You can go to our website, which is at www.wildpack.org.
Well, we're talking about the success and or failure of the environmental movement, and I'm curious to what degree you've participated in this debate.
With the elections, obviously, we've been directly involved with the activism of the environmental community, and we actually have seen great activity and great successes in light of course, the presidency, you know, the White House, we didn't win, but across the country there were winners, public lands leaders elected at all levels of government that we're very excited about and saw a lot of activity.
So does that tend to make you agree or disagree with the premise that environmentalism is dead?
I would have to strongly disagree. There are certainly some challenges that are ahead of us, and over, I'd say, you know, the past 4 years since George Bush became president, there's been a huge effort, an unprecedented effort by the oil, mining, and timber interests to invest hundreds of millions of dollars to help elect their friends. And I think right now they're holding all the cards in Washington with, you know, the Senate, the House, and the White House, that it's understandable that this is a challenging time to go up against these kind of resources and this kind of money, but this is not something that is necessarily new for the environmental community.
Now, in terms of empowering the environmental community to be more effective, what would be ideas that you feel would lead to greater success, particularly at the political level, which is where you focus?
Well, I think, you know, I wouldn't have to go too far from my own state to point to an example of success in where areas where the environmental community can build and grow on. And that's right here in Colorado with Ken Salazar being elected to the Senate. You know, he was elected in a deep red state with the slogan of for the land, water, and people. And he's a fifth-generation rancher, and he's a conservationist. So I think there are certainly opportunities and ways the environmental community can be electing more leaders in these traditional so-called red states that we need to be looking at. And part of this discussion, which I think is a healthy discussion, is figuring out what are those challenges and how can we rise to those occasions to try and figure that out.
That does sound like an extraordinary success. What would you say in Colorado was the basis for his success?
I think it was a combination of his background. He was a fifth-generation Coloradan, a rancher. He came from a family farm. He spoke to a lot of the values of his beliefs of conservationism and really resonated with people on those basic core issues. And he wasn't afraid to talk about them, too. I think one of the challenges sometimes that we face is politicians don't talk about the environment, where he embraced it and he talked about it in terms of values and his how he grew up and how he believed the land should be protected and the water is critical to business, to families, to health, to issues that are important to Colorado. So I think he was very successful in that.
In the last presidential election, the environment was almost essentially off the radar. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think I would agree that at the national level, the environment was not a part of debate, and I think that's certainly an area that was an opportunity for John Kerry to talk about the president's terrible, abysmal record on the environment. He didn't, for whatever reasons, take up that opportunity. But I think at a more, certainly at the state level, at the local level, we saw the environment throughout the campaign. Specifically in Colorado, both Ken Salazar and John Salazar, his brother who was elected to the House, talked about water issues. Just looking at our candidates in Oregon, David Wu talked about the environment. In Washington State, Christine Gregoire, the newly elected governor, talked about the importance of public lands and protection there. And even down to the county level, just to give you another example, similar to the Ken Salazar example in Colorado, a county council race in, believe it or not, Salt Lake County couldn't get more red than Utah, and a Democrat beat the Republican incumbent, and she talked about protecting Utah's wildlands. The environment was a part of the political debate, more at the local and state level, but it didn't rise to the national level. And that's something, you know, you could look in hindsight to whether Kerry took advantage of that or not, but didn't make it to the level of the debate.
One of the factors that was brought up in the paper and the extended debate was the fact that although the environment as an issue is actually something that most Americans are in favor of, quote-unquote, the environment, but that, unfortunately, their support for it isn't very deep. What's been your experience around that?
I would have to disagree, particularly just looking back to this election. WildPack was created in 2001, and in part it was created because of the potential threats to wilderness and public lands by George Bush. And, of course, now that we've seen this is real, we've been able to see both the increased activism and involvement of a community that wasn't there before, going from zero to 2,500 members, raising and spending $650,000 to elect wilderness leaders at the, you know, as I said, at all levels of government. That wasn't there before. And I think you can point to other new and different kinds of groups similar to WildPack, like there's a new Oceans Pack, there's a Solar Pack. There are groups that are being created and growing because of this new activism of wanting to get involved and seeing that politics is a part of the solution to wanting to protect the environment. It's more than just recycling. It's more than just cleaning up your local park. It's electing members who are going to stand for that, for those issues.
You spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C., meeting with representatives and senators and promoting preservation of wilderness and wild places. When you actually sit down with these folks, what's been your experience? I mean, do they talk one thing and do another, or just share that with us, please?
My experience has been very positive in working and developing relationships with the members that we support. So, for example, one great example is Nancy Johnson from Connecticut, who's the leader for the Republicans to protect the Arctic Refuge. She was one of our first candidates that we supported in 2002. She had a tough race, and we helped to get her reelected. And she has continued to be a leader on these issues and support these issues. So we've certainly seen of the people that we have supported continued leadership and growth and needing new leaders, too. And that's part of it is that we need more leaders as well as votes in Congress, because right now we don't have the votes to protect wilderness and public lands or for issues that we want to see passed right now in Congress.
As you look into the short-term future here, what are issues that are on your table that you're working on?
Well, no question, the upcoming fight to protect the Arctic Refuge is the largest public lands and wilderness issue right now as far as nationally. And we're seeing that in a lot of different forms. Just going back to the power and the control in Washington right now, it's the oil, mining, and timber interests that, you know, hold all the cards. So it's going to be a tough battle. This is one where there is national support for wanting to protect the Arctic Refuge. The American public continues through polling to show that they want this area protected for future generations and that it's something that should not be touched, and that there are other ways to find conservation through energy efficiency or, you know, other ways. But that, no question, is, I think, one of the biggest upcoming fights. But then there's also kind of the resurrection of things that didn't happen in the last Congress in areas in Colorado, New Mexico, the western states where they are dealing with oil and gas drilling, and just this aggressive position that this administration is taking to open up the West to oil and gas drilling.
That's going to become a huge battle, and I think the mandate is adding a lot of kindling to his fire. What are your hopes that we'll be able to sort of turn that around?
Well, I think that goes back to what WildHack works on, which is to help elect state and local officials who can, you know, send up through the chain to their senators and members of Congress to say, this isn't what we want, because in many of these western states, it's very localized, and whether it's Wyoming or New Mexico with Otero Mesa, the local communities don't want the oil and gas drilling, yet the Washington oil, you know, funded by the oil mining and timber interests, want to see that happen. So it's really trying to elect state and local level candidates who can protect these areas and be active on the ground to try and make sure it doesn't happen.
How is the public expressing their concern to protect their lands, those that do? You know, what are the issues that really have power and resonate with them that you're hearing?
Well, certainly there's wanting to protect these lands for future generations. I think that's one thing that Americans want to see, that they can bring their kids or their grandkids to their favorite park or their favorite canyon that they can go visit. But I think one thing that you had mentioned, that oil and gas is really, you know, I think they're a cutting edge issue where we're going to see a lot more of it and a lot more effects of it, is gets to also our air and our water, that there are ramifications of that activity that goes into our groundwater, that goes into our air quality, so really affecting the whole quality of life, I think, which is the core issue of wanting to protect our environment, protect our quality of life.
Are you hearing people discussing this? Is this generating discussion within the environmental community?
I don't believe so. I mean, it is in a very small handful of its leaders, but when you get out to the communities, there's no sign of it.
And that may be part of the important message, and that is something that I keep hearing as well, that for those people who are out in the field, they keep working.
It's a discussion, and it's an important one, and, you know, looking to particularly this last election, we need to look at things and analyze and ask some tough questions, but I'd say the majority of folks are moving forward and continuing to work hard.
Vicki, is there anything else that you'd like to share in this regard, this issue and this topic?
Just to reiterate that I think that that this debate is an important one, and that these guys are asking some tough questions, but clearly environmentalism is not dead and it's not going away. And the debate is an important one, and if anything, it's only going to strengthen and build the community to be a stronger and more effective group.
Vicki Cimarano, Executive Director of WildHack, I want to thank you for giving your thoughts on the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
I want to thank you for listening to this special edition of the Wild Side News. The one thing that is clear is that the environmental movement is a vital, diverse, impassioned, dedicated alliance, sometimes formal, often very personal, of great and amazing people. Are we witnessing the death of environmentalism? Based on the voices of the earth I've heard today, I say no, not at all. There's no way that the millions of people who love the earth, who care about the wild lands and grand and mysterious creatures, who walk amongst the cedars or sleep beneath the starry, starry skies, will ever disappear. And in all fairness to Michael Schellenberger and Ted Nordhaus, I say thanks. I hope your clarion call sounds clear, that we must grow and change with a changing environment, just like anything that wants to stay alive. If anything, this will anneal our will to live for life, for our future, for our nation, and hopefully, sometime before too long, the wisdom to live in peace with all of life on Earth. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios
and thanks for hearing this special Voice of the Earth presentation. We will succeed. The Voice of the Earth is growing louder. Thanks for listening.